Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents America's Good Terrorist, John Brown and the Harper's Ferry Raid, by Charles P. Poland, Jr. Narrated by David Stifel. Introduction. John Brown is a common name, but the John Brown who masterminded the failed raid at Harper's Ferry in 1859 was anything but common. His thwarted efforts have left an imprint upon our history, and his story still swirls in controversy. Was he a madman who felt his violent solution to slavery was ordained by Providence, or a heroic freedom fighter who tried to liberate the downtrodden slave? These bipolar characterizations of the violent abolitionist have captivated Americans. The prevailing view from the time of the raid to well into the 20th century, that his actions were the product of an unbalanced mind, has shifted to the idea that he committed courageous acts to undo a terrible injustice. The debate still rages, but not as much about his ultimate goal as the method he used in attempting to right what he considered an intolerable wrong. Are citizens justified in bypassing the normal legal or governmental processes in a violent way when these fail, in the eyes of the dissenter, to correct a wrong that touched so many? Brown's use of violence was to strike terror into the hearts of slave owners. Terror that Brown hoped would intimidate them to free their slaves to ensure their families' safety. Terrorism is a frightening element in our lives, especially since 9/11. Modern terrorism is varied and complex. The meaning of terrorism has changed over the last 200 years, making a simple definition difficult. It should not be confused with guerrilla warfare, insurgency, or criminal activity for one's self-aggrandizement. The FBI, U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. State Department, U.K. government, and individual authors give different definitions, but most identify the same common elements. David J. Whitaker, editor of the Terrorism Reader, addresses these issues and concludes that the fundamental aim of the terrorist's violence is to change the system, motivated by the altruistic belief that he is serving a good cause designed to achieve a greater good for a wider constituency, whether real or imagined. Terrorists never acknowledge that they are terrorists and go to great lengths to obscure that identity. All terrorist acts, according to Whitaker, involve violence or the threat of violence. He defines terrorism as the deliberate creation and exploitation of fear through violence or the threat of violence in the pursuit of political change. Advancements in communication and weaponry technology have enabled modern terrorists to target indiscriminately and to inflict mayhem on civilians. Despite the differences between modern terrorist acts and Brown's own violent acts, when Brown's characteristics are compared to the definition of terrorism as set forth by scholars of terrorism, he fits the profile. Nevertheless, today Brown is a martyred hero who gave his life attempting to terminate the evil institution of human bondage. Brown's violent method of using terrorism to accomplish this is downplayed or ignored, despite his labeling by historians as America's first terrorist. The modern view of Brown has unintentionally made him a good terrorist, despite the repugnance of terrorism that makes the thought of a benevolent or good terrorist an oxymoron. The title America's Good Terrorist reflects the shift in view of the violent abolitionist from villain to hero, and does not imply terrorism is benevolent. Chapter 1. The Making of a Terrorist. Nature's grandeur at Harper's Ferry laid an engaging stage for one of America's great dramas, John Brown's Raid. The setting was a relatively small town, walled in by water and cliffs, some 60 miles west of the nation's capital, by rail 70 miles west of Baltimore, and 170 miles north of the Old Dominion's capital, Richmond. Captain Brown's War of Liberation would bring excitement and anxiety of a magnitude previously unknown at Harper's Ferry. The raid had shocking repercussions that strained the political sinews binding the nation together, strained them almost to the point of rupture. But this raid was only the beginning. The residents of this town, located in an area of such unusual geographic beauty, had no way of knowing what impending trauma and change would invade their world. The Golden Age of Harper's Ferry. The town's businesses clustered along the Potomac and Shenandoah shores, on a neck of land shaped like a shark's head. The river's water powered the town's mills and factories. The Civil War and later floods would destroy and sweep away most of these businesses and the homes on the Shenandoah bank. Today, the surrounding heights around Harper's Ferry, the confluence of two rivers, and remaining historic structures still provide magnificent scenery for gawking tourists, though most of the structures that were focal points during the abolitionist raid have disappeared. Buildings hugging the cliffs or nearby along Shenandoah Street still stand, along with those on the lower part of High Street and North Potomac Street, next to the Armory site, which housed early businesses. Modern tourists may see dwellings such as the Harper House, which sits on rising terrain traversed by High Street. The most dramatic vista is still obtained by trudging up the stone steps to St. Peter's Catholic Church, then continuing on the path past the remains of St. John's Episcopal Church to Jefferson's Rock. Behind it, on even higher ground, is a 4-acre burial site, containing among the still and quiet remains those of the town's founder, Robert Harper. Further up on a plateau are several historic houses and buildings on Camp Hill, used in the 19th and 20th centuries by Storer College for African Americans. Gone are the numerous structures that formed the town's heart. Only remnants remain of two of the three canals. The only building left on the outer rim of low land is the much-moved engine house, better known as John Brown's Fort. The bridges that replaced the two covered toll crossings have also been moved. Stone walls still frame the tip of land, but the one along the Potomac is all that remains of the masonry that surrounded the quarter-mile-long United States musket factory, the armory, that once consisted of 21 buildings. No trace can be found of the United States Canal, which entered from the west to power the armory's turbines. The modern visitor will only find railroad tracks, a train station, scattered loose railroad ties, and numerous unfriendly no trespassing signs on 20-foot-high mounds of fill dirt running through what was the federal government's largest arms plant. These mounds obscure any view of the original armory grounds. The nose of the shark's head, called the Point, was once home to a toll house, two rail depots, the Potomac Restaurant, Wagner House, and Galt House Saloon. All are gone. Just to the south, only vague and sunken outlines remain of the two arsenal buildings. Along the Shenandoah Bank, wilderness hides the rail tracks to Winchester and covers land that was once three islands, Upper Hall, Lower Hall, and Virginius, that collectively form the outline of the Shark's Mouth. The Shenandoah Canal separates the islands from town, and the Shenandoah River borders them on the other side. A curving dam once funneled water to power machinery in most of the nine buildings of the rifle works on Lower Hall Island, as well as Virginius Island's tannery and iron, flour, saw, and cotton mills. In warm weather, tourists swarm the remains of the historic sites. Harper's Ferry of the 1850s was a thriving town nearing the end of its golden age. It was the site of numerous businesses, The most important was arms manufacturing. The U.S. Armory, the arsenal, the rifle factory, and other businesses employed a large number of the white wage earners among the town's 2,500 residents, half white and half black. The majority of the white residents were from the north, considered foreigners by those of southern heritage, and provided skilled workers for the town, as well as artisans for the government armory and for Hall's Rifle Works, which produced nearly 9,000 stands of arms in 1859. The region's economy did not foster large plantations and slaveholding. Although Harper's Ferry had 1,339 black residents, only 88 were enslaved. The six Virginia and Maryland counties surrounding the town had a white population of 115,000 and 18,048 black people who were enslaved, of whom fewer than 5,000 were men. Free blacks in these counties numbered 9,800. In the Old Dominion at the time, a third of the residents were in bondage. Railroads were integral to the town's prosperity, especially the Baltimore and Ohio, or B&O, which made Harper's Ferry an important rail link between the East and the Ohio Valley. An additional railroad and canal supplemented the B&O, the Winchester and Potomac Railroad, which joined the B&O line at Harper's Ferry, and the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal, which followed the meandering northern banks of the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. to Cumberland, Maryland. The Federal Armory had its genesis during the presidency of George Washington, who was impressed with the regional abundance of elements necessary for arms production: water power, iron ore, and hardwood timber. In 1796, the federal government purchased land from the heirs of Robert Harper, and that land became the site of the armory, then in the state of Virginia. Production started in 1798. Economic growth and technological advancements in arms production caused growing pains for the area during its pre-Civil War golden age. Locals had lived in an isolated environment prior to the 1830s, and they clung to craft production and were slow to adopt technological advances because they feared these would bring lower wages. Federal authorities instituted measures to heighten control over arms production to eliminate lax work habits, such as employees arriving at and leaving work whenever they wished. The people of Harper's Ferry resented the increased federal control, considering it an unwarranted intrusion upon the independence and the rights of the worker. Prior to John Brown's raid, workers were similarly displeased with Superintendent Alfred M. Barber's firing of more than 100 workers. Those who were retained took a 10% reduction in wages and had to abide by more rigid regulations. Harper's Ferry's unique setting has impressed travelers since the colonial era. A Philadelphia architect, Robert Harper, was so enamored with the region known as the Hole, or Peter's Hole, that in 1747 he purchased the land there from the first settler, ferry operator Peter Stevens. Harper's purchase and improvement of the ferry service resulted in a name change to Harper's Ferry. Thomas Jefferson, in his Notes on Virginia, wrote about the area, apparently from a viewpoint on what has since been called Jefferson's Rock. He described the confluence of the Potomac and the Shenandoah rivers and the mountains that bordered them as one of the most stupendous scenes in nature. God's Avenger. Such was the setting John Brown selected for his attack upon slavery, an attack that the old man, as acquaintances and the press called him, believed would terminate that evil institution. But it was not the grandeur of the scenery that attracted Brown. Instead, it was the existence of the U.S. Arms facilities at Harper's Ferry, a town located in a border region that Brown wrongly assumed would supply numerous black and white supporters who would liberate the slaves through guerrilla warfare. The original appeal of seizing federal property to obtain weapons for those he planned to liberate seemed to be less a motive at the time of the raid. By then, Brown had weapons for them. By 1859, he had more important motivations: retribution against a government that would protect slavery, and the publicity from such a bold act. Brown assumed this raid would launch his revolution. An additional attraction was the town's proximity to a mountain chain that Brown could retreat to and use as an avenue for deeper penetration into the slave kingdom. Several threads ran through John Brown's life: business failure, debt, abolition, and religion. He enjoyed early business success, evolving from shepherd, tanner, farmer, and cattleman to real estate speculator and wool merchant, but fell upon difficult times. From 1831 to 1853, he was constantly in debt as a result of 15 business failures. Brown's dependence on credit, lack of judgment, and stubbornness doomed him in business deals. Debt frequently landed him in court, and by 1842 he was bankrupt. Brown headed a large household, and possessions were sparse. At one point, 12 Brown children slept in 5 beds. The family's austere life included plain clothing and food. Milk and water were their only drinks, although later in his life Brown sipped tea or coffee to avoid offending a well-meaning hostess. Tobacco and liquor were forbidden, and for some reason John would never eat butter. The one thing the Brown household had in abundance reflected John's priority in life: religion. They owned 11 Bibles and half a dozen New Testaments. Brown's first wife, Dianthe Lusk Brown, delivered 7 children in 12 years of marriage. In 1832, she died of heart failure 3 days after giving birth to a stillborn son. Brown lost 9 of his 20 children, 7 from his second marriage. While living in Ohio, Brown and his second wife, Mary Ann Day Brown, lost 3 children to dysentery within 11 days. 9-year-old Sarah, 2-year-old Peter, and 1-year-old Austin were buried in the same grave as their 4-year-old brother Charles, who had died 2 years earlier. Those years proved to be decades of frustration and despair. Why did John Brown attack Harper's Ferry in an attempt to end what he considered America's greatest sin? One must look at the dominant anti-slavery influences in his life. His father, an abolitionist environment, Calvinism, slave revolts, Oliver Cromwell, guerrilla warfare, and a belief the government was guilty of malfeasance. John Brown's anti-slavery feelings formed in his early years. He was born in Torrington, Connecticut, on May 9, 1800, to Owen and Ruth Brown. His mother was the daughter of a Congregational minister, for whom John was named. In the 1850s, John Brown briefly sketched his childhood in an essay, A Boy Named John. It was written in response to a request from one of his financial backers, Henry Stearns, and it focused on Brown's youthful errors, in hopes young Stearns would avoid them. The autobiography tells of the struggles and hard work in Connecticut and on the frontier in Ohio, of Brown's dislike of school, and of his proclivity to lie to avoid punishment. It also tells of traumatic events, including his mother's death, losses of a yellow marble and a bobtailed squirrel, the death of his pet lamb, and the horror of seeing a young slave boy about his age beaten by a master with a shovel. At times during his youth, Brown wrote, he had a strong desire to die. Brown had his lighter moments, often engaging in pranks. In his significant biography of Brown, Oswald Villard tells an unsubstantiated story of John's attempt to ignite gunpowder under his stepmother, and then patting his pants to counter the sting of his father's thrashing. Hijinks aside, adult responsibilities were thrust upon John when he was barely an adolescent. When the War of 1812 started, Owen sent his young son alone, barefoot and dressed in buckskins, to drive cattle over 100 miles of wilderness from Ohio to outposts in Michigan. John was raised to revere strict Puritan values, and he was shocked by contact with the undisciplined, cussing, complaining soldiers. The shame of General William Hull's surrender of Detroit further disillusioned him. John's disdain for the military carried through into adulthood, when he refused to show up for mandatory militia drills, instead opting to pay fines. At 16, John was preparing to enter the ministry, but an eye infection and lack of funds doomed this ambition. He left school and returned to Ohio. Owen Brown had a profound influence upon his son. John's father, who was restless and moved frequently, was a stern disciplinarian who was liberal in his use of corporal punishment, a common practice of that era. A religiously devout man who was strongly opposed to slavery, Owen stuttered severely, except when praying. Like his father, John would later move from place to place. Corporal punishment was passed down as well. John Brown whipped his sons, especially his older sons. When 3-year-old Jason claimed a dream was real, John punished him for lying. John also kept a detailed account book of his son John Jr.'s sinful acts and the number of whiplashes each merited. John Jr. recalled that one Sunday morning, his father said it was time for settlement. He recounted, "After a long and tearful talk over my faults, he again showed me my account. I paid about 1/3 the debt from a nicely prepared blue beach switch. Then, to my utter astonishment, father took off his shirt and gave me the whip." The senior John Brown told the son to whip his bare back and to strike harder and harder as he took the remaining lashes for his son. Historians James Davidson and Mark Little contend that Owen's harsh treatment of John led to a deep feeling of loyalty and submission, countered by a strong desire for independence. John's similar treatment of his sons caused Watson Brown to tell his father, "The trouble is, father, you want your boys to be brave as tigers and still afraid of you." Yet John Brown was remembered fondly by his daughter Annie, a product of his second marriage. She recalled not just a rigorous disciplinarian, but a caring, loving father. "He was very strict in his ideas of discipline, but he played with his children often, and waited upon and cared for us at night. He never complained about getting up in the middle of a cold night and drawing a bucket of water to fetch his daughter a drink, because he said that water that stood in the house was not good to drink. Before going to bed, he bounced Annie on his knee and carried her about, singing her to sleep and tucking her into bed. He continued the practice until she was nearly 8. She sat on his lap during business meetings, taking everything out of her papa's pockets to play with, and then carefully returning the items. He told Annie and her siblings stories and riddles, and amused them by making shadow pictures of animals on the wall with his hands. Annie recalled, "He seldom ever came home from an absence of even a day without bringing the children something, such as oranges, nuts, raisins, and fruits, or popcorn, never candy, but books for those who were old enough to read. All children who were with him for a short time formed a strong attachment for him." The paramount influence of Owen Brown upon John was in religion and a hatred of slavery. Owen was a descendant of Peter Brown, who supposedly came over on the Mayflower in 1620, though records indicate Peter probably arrived a dozen years later. Owen felt people were, in the words of Jonathan Edwards, "sinners in the hands of an angry God." Owen was an Orthodox Congregationalist and accepted Calvin's view of humans as wicked and feeble creatures whose duty was to resist Satan's temptations and live a life of Christian piety. In his early years, John considered becoming a minister, and he embraced his father's Calvinist view of a God of wrath and revenge, as well as the doctrine of predestination. As an adult, John Brown diligently studied Jonathan Edwards's On the Freedom of Will, which fueled his evangelical fever. It also prepared him to debate a pious, overconfident minister who, in their first argument, drowned out Brown's refuting of the doctrines of perfectionism and free will. Afterwards, Brown said the preacher was not a gentleman. Word of this traveled back to the minister, who confronted Brown. Not only did Brown take ownership of the statement, but he pointed out that he had also said, "It would take as many men like you to make a gentleman as it would take hens to make a cock turkey." Annoyed, the preacher engaged Brown in a second verbal sparring, and onlookers said Brown won the debate. Brown was devout, and religion so pervaded his daily life that he often turned business transactions into occasions for religious lectures and discussions. No book received more of his time than the Bible, especially the Old Testament. Brown felt he had found his commission from God there, and he marked Old Testament passages about God's wrath in bringing about the slaughter of the wicked and the enemies of God's chosen people. Both Owen and John believed it was their Christian duty to fight wickedness, and in their eyes, the greatest wickedness in the U.S. was slavery. Owen chose to fight slavery with the Underground Railroad, while John sought a violent solution. Years of studying Jehovah's violent destruction of the enemies of righteousness convinced John that God had chosen him to take action against slaveholders. His credo was one of his favorite marked passages, "Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins." He also sanctified the use of violence while talking with Ralph Waldo Emerson at the Transcendentalist's home in the late 1850s. Brown said he believed in the Bible and the Declaration of Independence, and said, "Better that a whole generation of men, women, and children should pass away by a violent death than a word of either should be violated." One of Brown's favorite biblical characters was Gideon. Under divine orders, Gideon delivered the Israelites from hordes of Midianites, who for years raided on Camelback, plundering, burning, and conducting massacres. Gideon claimed God had assured him a victory if he reduced his forces from thousands to 300. He divided his small force into three companies and startled the enemy in a surprise night attack. His men blew their trumpets and revealed lamps they had hidden inside pitchers, shouting, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon!" Confused enemy troops attacked each other and fled, and Gideon won. This tale made an indelible impression on John Brown. Gideon's small force was victorious against the overwhelming numbers of an evil enemy. He used violence and an element of surprise to carry out God's will in a unique nighttime attack. Brown's study of violence in Triumph Over Evil was not limited to his holy book. It extended to select aspects of history and to leaders who felt their violent acts were part of a divine mission, especially Spartacus, Cinque, Nat Turner, and Oliver Cromwell. Brown admired slaves who had led rebellions, but his idealization of them, as David S. Reynolds argues in his extensive biography, John Brown, Abolitionist, made Brown believe he would successfully spur a slave insurrection throughout the U.S. slave states. The life of Spartacus, who headed the most formidable of the many slave rebellions in Roman history, was also of great interest to Brown. Spartacus escaped from gladiator school to the mountains. Other men fleeing the cruel mistreatments of slavery joined him, and they formed an army that terrorized and laid waste to a large region. from the Alps to the southern tip of the peninsula, repeatedly defeating the powerful Roman.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?